Okay. And they're buying, aren't they? Hopefully some folks will come on straggling in. James McLaughlin is going to be speaking to us. He received his PhD in religious studies from the University of Toronto, and currently he teaches at Western Carolina University. And I'm sure we're all interested in hearing what he has to say. Well, it looks like there's a lot more people interested in Sunday school than in the Atonement. Okay. And they're buying, aren't they? Hopefully some folks will come on straggling in. James McLaughlin is going to be speaking to us. He received his PhD in religious studies from the University of Toronto, and currently he teaches at Western Carolina University. And I'm sure we're all interested in hearing what he has to say. So thanks.
I have this on, so that's official now. I get too nervous to wear one of those. I also have a serious chalkboard dependency, so if my hands are going like this and I'm writing something on an invisible blackboard, yeah, be aware of that. Sunstone's a fun thing to come to. One of the first times I ever offered a paper was at Sunstone, and it's the only time people ever got up and yelled at me during a conference. So we had a dialogue, you know. So one of the things nice about Sunstone is people do get passionate. This particular paper is kind of a paper that's in process. I got an email from Albert about a month or so ago asking if I was interested in giving something here at Sunstone. And in the past, I haven't done a whole lot of Mormon studies. I've been in the church all my life. I taught at BYU for a little while, but all my writing has been in existentialism and personalism, which was an American philosophical movement, and German idealism. And I recently started into writing a little bit on Mormon studies. I wrote an article on William Henry Chamberlain, who most people don't know who he was, but he was the first American, not first American, first Mormon to do formal studies in philosophy. And in a way, he's inspired this. But so in a month's time, I'm trying to think about Mormon idea of the atonement. And this is also inspired by being in Salt Lake last summer, and being at the Sunstone in Salt Lake and listening to Dennis Potter, who's a graduate student at Notre Dame's paper on the atonement, and Kim McCall's paper on the atonement, and then Janice Allred's response to those, and then having a rather long conversation with Blake Osler, who is some of you know Blake. He used to be box Golden Gloves, and I believe it. Once you've had a conversation with Blake, you feel like you've been through it. But it was a wonderful thing to talk to him again. The title is significant in a couple of ways. One of the things, to me anyway, is it says a Mormon idea of the atonement. I think that I admire Sterling McMurrin. I was on a couple of Sunstone panels with him, and he's a wonderful man, and I love the book, Theological Foundations of the Mormon Religion. But in the title, he was just, I think, dead wrong. Okay, he got it backwards. Religions don't have theological foundations. They have theological implications, not only historically, but I think even metaphysically. Religious experience is first, and theological reflection is later. What theological reflection does is to, at least for some of us who need to do it, I don't know that everyone in the church needs to do it, but for those of us who do, it is an attempt to play with the meaning, to flesh out the meaning of the revelation, which isn't always clear to us. And in doing that, we are often wrong, and indeed, we often should be. Okay? Because that's part of the fun of the play. A lot of people probably, and this is something I hadn't realized either, because but a lot of people probably have never heard the word of kenosis before. This is a term that's used largely in the Eastern Orthodox, especially Russian Orthodox Church, that expresses the idea that the pre-existent Christ emptied or humiliated himself to become human. Okay, we'll talk a bit about what that could mean. But it's also an idea that became extremely important to some Russian Orthodox writers and philosophers at the end of the 19th century and into the 20th century. The most famous one, of course, is Fyodor Dostoevsky. And if you read Brothers Karamazov, even though Dostoevsky never really explicitly uses the term kenosis, the idea of what's called the kenotic Christ is is something that runs throughout the novel. It's the answer to the Grand Inquisitor. And the other people who were important with this is one of Dostoevsky's disciples, who was widely read up till about 20 years ago. And since then, he's kind of fallen off the face of the earth. But a Russian existentialist writer, Nikolai Berdyaev. Some of you might know that name, maybe not. But I'm going to talk a lot about them, and I'm going to talk about some 19th and 20th century personalist philosophers who, though they didn't use the term, certainly understood Christ in what we call kenotic terms. Let me start out by reading, and let me start out by putting my watch up here so I know where I am. I have a tendency to go on and on and on, so if I do, you know, yell at me or something. Okay. But the Gospel of John, I'm going to read two passages from the Scripture just to talk, start out with here. The Gospel of John, chapter 12, verse 24. This is the passage that Dostoevsky used for dedication, sort of the dedicatory passage in the Brother Karamazov. And if I can find John, chapter 12, verse 24. That would be helpful. Okay, here it is. Verily, verily, I say unto you, except the corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit. Then where the term's actually used in the Bible is in Philippians chapter 2, verses 6 to 11, and it's part of a kind of hymn that some biblical scholars think actually that Paul is referring to. So this is an old piece of early Christianity. I'm going to read verses 1 to 11, so this is going to be a long quote. If there therefore be any consolation in Christ, if any comfort of love, if any fellowship of the Spirit, if any bowels and mercy, fulfill ye my joy, that ye be like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord and one mind. Let nothing be done through strife and vainglory, and lowliness of mind, that each esteem the other better than themselves. Look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, himself, who being in the form of God, though thought it not robbery to be equal to God, but made himself no reputation, and took upon himself the form of a servant. This is the kenotic idea, notion of self-emptying, and made in the likeness of man. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even death of the cross. Wherefore God also hath highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow of things in heaven and things in earth and things under the earth, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus is the Lord, the glory of God the Father. Now we read that those last two verses all the time. We don't read the first nine very often. But the first nine are concerned with the notion of the kenotic Christ. Also concerned with, I think, with the notion of our own activity. Quick word search through the various LDS CD-ROMs. I've got a couple of them, you know, you can get. You stick them in your computer and you type in the word, and you don't have to do really hard research anymore because it does it all for you. Came through the list of thousands of references to the atonement, but only two to a canonic idea of Christ. And only those had to say that this was a position held by certain 19th century Lutheran theologians. I don't find it surprising that Mormons have not said much explicitly about the canonic interpretation of the atonement, because the way the term has been used in Western theologies has emphasized two natures of Christ, divine and human. Now, the tendency has been to take the divine nature. They talk about a hypostatic union. And this is related largely to Greek notions of perfection. The divine nature of God is eternal, atemporal, unchanging, perfect. Could not possibly change. The human nature of Christ, of God incarnate, is what changes, what suffers, what's like us. Now somehow, and this was the decision they came to at the Council of Chalcedon in 451, somehow these are held together. Now, if you look at the list of heresies in the early church, the heresies were always to absorb the human nature in the divine nature, or to absorb the divine nature in the human nature. Okay? And we could get into all sorts of... to read these old Christological controversies is pretty fun. It's also, if you think that you could get in trouble in the church today by saying certain things, you know, back then they were really serious about this stuff. Anyway, the tradition emphasized these two natures. Moreover, Mormons over the years, I think for good reason, have steered clear from all these intricacies of Christology. We generally don't talk about them. In fact, we talk about Christ's divine nature as the literal Son of God and human nature as the Son of Mary. We do not have difficulties shared by the post-Nicene Christians who see these natures as ontologically different. Since Mormons rejected creation ex nihilo, there is no difference in being, capital B, between the divine and the human realms. In fact, for many Mormons, God has been perceived as a deep anterior ancestor, and there is no difference between the gods and humanity because humanity is potentially divine. At least this is what I used to think Mormons believed until last summer at Sunstone. I met a few that didn't. But the atonement has always been a difficult concept for me, and I believe many Mormons, because the simplicity of the Mormon sacred universe does not contain two realms of being, one eternal, one atemporal, and one divine, and the other temporal created. And this makes most traditional explanations of the atonement, whether they be ransoms or satisfactions, unavailable to us, even though we still use them. The most recent example of this, I think, is Stephen Robinson's book, was it Believing Christ? Where you have the parable of the bicycle and stuff. This is basically the old satisfaction theory. And a lot of people will go to Alma 42 and say, well, see, this is what it is. Hopefully I'll get that far. But you have to look at Alma 42 as being a satisfaction theory of the atonement. A lot of these old theories are based on an old kind of theological, philosophical view of the universe that I don't think we share with the rest of Christianity. Okay. The world is filled... But neither do I believe that Neo- or semi-Pelagian solutions are very satisfactory either. That's to believe that, you know, we can do it ourselves, sort of, we can save ourselves through works. We cannot simply say that Christ lived a perfect life and showed us the way to triumph over the suffering of the world through our good works, because the world is filled with too much tragedy for us even to hope to make it right. I propose that the Mormon reading of the atonement that is offered in the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants, does not have to be seen as either a ransom or a satisfaction theory, and is best understood in terms of a canonic explanation of self-emptying. And in looking for the canonic explanation that works best, we should not search the traditional Western theological and philosophical understanding, but turn to a Russian Orthodox understanding of the canonic Christ, and to 19th and 20th century personalist interpretations of the divine-human relationship. Okay, well, basically in the, I'm going to talk through most of this because it gets pretty, you know, like a philosophy paper, and I'll put you all to sleep really fast if I do that. So anyway, basically there are four basic theories that have been put forward in Christian theory, in Christian tradition about the atonement. The one is the classic dramatic theory, or the ransom theory. And this goes back to the Middle Ages, and there are marvelous plays done based on the ransom theory. And it was reinvigorated in the 16th century by Martin Luther, who also liked it, because Luther was always having these experiences with the devil. Right? The ransom theory, after the fall, we are part of the devil's kingdom. It's as if we've become slaves to sin and the devil. And so Christ is offered, you know, as a lure. As a matter of fact, the church fathers and used even the metaphor as Christ on a hook, as the worm. Because Christ is without sin, when Lucifer grasps at the worm to pull it in, he breaks the rules, and we are all freed. Okay, so Christ is offered as a ransom to the devil to free our souls. And in that respect, this is where Luther looked at it, the victory has already been won, and we enjoy the fruits now, and this makes atonement Christ's work and not ours. The theory shows up in many medieval... Okay, no need to read that again. Okay, that's the first one. I find that one the most unsatisfactory because, you know, it's as if... because it becomes entirely Christ's work and not ours. And from a Mormon point of view, there's something about the atonement that seems that we should be involved in it. The other thing is that the idea of this notion of just paying a ransom reduces a moral relationship with God to a legal one. And we'll see that with a lot of these theories of the atonement. They are primarily legal and what we call ontological theories. Theories about the being of the universe, and not about our moral relationship with God, which is what I think we are called to in the Scriptures. Okay, the second theory is the sacrificial theory. This one appears especially in the book of Hebrews. And in this one, we've got a notion, this is also called propitiation, where Christ, we have broken the law, and this is also a way that a lot of people will read Alma 42, that we have broken the law created by God, and so a debt has to be paid. Okay? And Christ is the perfect priest and victim at the same time and pays the debt for us. Now, of course, the difficulty here is that God has created a debt. You know, it invalidates the love of God in a way. It says God can't be merciful to us because of some debt that we are involved in with God. Okay, let's go on to a third one, the juridical or satisfaction theory. And this was put forward by Anselm in the 11th century, in his book Curdus Homo. Here Christ satisfies the outraged anger of God, who here is conceived as man's feudal overlord. The ransom is paid not to the devil, but to God. Christ, as a man, bore the penalty for human sin, and substitution language is in reality talking about not about the love of God. We are changed into seeing someone else suffer for us. God's justice is under no obligation to man. We have violated the contract with God unjustly. We have nothing to offer God because everything we have is God's gift to us. God's mercy and love makes it appropriate for him to forgive us, but from the point of view of justice, he owes us nothing and cannot violate justice by force or fiat without violating himself. We owe a tremendous debt, and God has the means to pay, but owns no debt. The appropriate sacrifice would have to come from one who is both God and man, and as God who represents the whole human race, Christ owes the debt as God, and he can pay it. Christ's sacrifice answers the demands of justice. And if you read Robinson's book, I think this is the one he kind of comes up with. Of course, the problem here is, if we usually think about legal theory, the idea of someone paying a debt for us sounds okay, except unless you think of it in terms of things like murder, or where an innocent victim, once again, doesn't seem to substituting for us. Say if we had somebody who, one of the examples that Potter used in his paper, say we had somebody who believed in Timothy McVeigh and offered to pay the debt for him. I mean, there would be something wrong with this. Seems like there has to be some kind of involvement on our own part in the atonement. Anyway, finally, the last one is the one that actually does demand our involvement in it, and that's the subjective moral or exemplarist theory. And this was first put forward by Peter Abelard in the 12th century. And what Abelard is concerned with in the moral exemplarist theory is the change of the human heart. Okay, and if you think of the Book of Mormon, where I think the primary idea is the mighty change of heart, it sounds like Abelard's theory would be the closest. The difficulty, though, with Abelard's theory has become that Christ's example, calling us to live the Christly life, although I find that much more much more sympathetic than some of the other theories. The difficulty is that we are not. It doesn't seem how. I don't see how this solves the problem of the tragedy of the world, because certainly we're not all going to do it. And the difficulty comes in there because of the kind of metaphysics that was involved in the early church, where we are seen as always wanting in relation to an idea of pure perfection. Okay. In the traditional Christian understanding of the canonic Christ, it's tied to a hypostatic union of Christ's two natures, the divine and the human. Traditional Christianity has emphasized the difference between the two natures, the divine being eternal, infinite, human, finite, and temporal. The Christological disputes of the early church concerned how the tension between these two vastly different natures might be held together in one being. Christ suffered, but the classical understanding of Christology began with the Godhead and the Son and proceeded deductively from that idea of perfection. It tends to emphasize God in himself as opposed to God with us character of Christ as we experience Christ on earth, and seems to show Christ's human nature is somehow incompatible with his earthly character and glory. This claim that method never produced an adequate definition of Christ's humanity. The tendency was, despite verbal safeguards, to lapse into something called monophysitism, which was to absorb Christ's human nature into the divine nature. The alternate method was inductive. The way to the knowledge of Jesus leads from the human to Jesus, the Son of God, and the Godhead. This type has been advocated by an increasing number of theologians since the 19th century, since Kant. This is inheritor of the moral theory. Here, humanity is given an unquestionable, but basic assumption was that there was a kind of continuity between the divine and the human that made it possible to ascend from the one and the other. Theologians under the influence of Kant tended to look in this for this in the ethical direction. They moved from the metaphysical to an ethical key. The period switched from the Christ of classical Christology to the Jesus who was portrayed in the Gospels as a moral exemplar. And the best example of this, if you want something that is more understandable than reading traditional Christian theology, is to read something like Victor Hugo, Les Miserables. Take, for example, this. I'm going to cut a little bit of this out, but this passage in the the famous story. You've all seen the play, you've read the book or something. The story, Jean Valjean is convicted of stealing a loaf of bread. He spends 20 years in prison for it. He is let out. He wanders around looking for a place to lay his head, and he comes to the in a little town. He comes to the house of the Catholic bishop. Hugo has spent a whole volume of Les Miserables, explaining the character of this particular Catholic bishop. But the bishop takes him in, and Valjean eats with him. They have a discussion about suffering. Valjean steals the bishop's silver plates, and he's captured by the gendarmes. He's brought back, and the bishop looks at him and tells the gendarmes that he gave him the plates, and takes Valjean aside, looks at him and says, "Forget not, never forget that you have promised me to use this silver to become an honest man." Jean Valjean had no recollection of this promise, stood dumbfounded. The bishop had laid much stress upon these words as he uttered them, and he continued solemnly, "Jean Valjean, my brother, you belong no longer to evil but to good. It is your soul that I am buying for you. I withdraw it from the dark thoughts and from the spirit of perdition, and I give it God." Now, certainly you could read that passage as the good old ransom theory, "I've paid the debt for you," but it works far better, and it certainly did for Hugo, who's writing after Kant, as a wonderful example of the moral theory of the atonement, especially because this thing, it takes a while to work in Valjean. If you remember, he leaves the little town, he goes walking off into the woods, he runs into the young boy, Petit Gervais, and he steals his money. Okay? He does what convicts do, And then he is overcome by feelings of remorse, and he goes running along, "Petit Gervais, Petit Gervais!" And, of course, the kid is too scared. He's run far away from him. But the atonement works in him. He changes. He becomes a moral person. And this becomes kind of like this is the popular idea in the 19th century, that it's this moral idea of Christ that's going to change us. In fact, a lot of this is based on Kant's wonderful book, Religion Within the Limits of Reason Alone. And in there, Kant says that it's not even necessary that Christ have lived, but only that we have the idea of Christ as a perfect moral example, as the person who perfectly obeys Kant's rational moral law, which is to treat humanity, whether in yourself and in others, as an end in itself and never only as a means to your ends. Now, the difficulty with that, and the difficulty even with Hugo's Jean Valjean, is the one that's enunciated by Ivan Katsov in the famous passage from Brothers Karamazov on rebellion, where Ivan and Alyosha meet in a bar. And Ivan starts to tell Alyosha all of these horrible stories about the suffering of children. He talks about the Turks in Bulgaria blowing out children's brains. He talks about a child who was abused by her educated parents, rubbed with excrement, and forced to stay in an outhouse. This part, this is just before he goes into the Grand Inquisitor, but this part ends with Ivan saying that he returns his admission tickets to God, that he cannot accept this universe. And so on the one hand, you have this massive rejection by Ivan of a good deal of the Christian tradition that has tried to explain suffering in the world through an aesthetic argument, or an ontological argument. That's why you get the great chain of being. And in that, hell becomes even a good place because it's an example of God's justice. This is the song Bette Midler sang a few years ago, "From a Distance, Everything Looks Good." If you can, or the one that we use all from the funerals when we say, when we could see it from God's point of view, you'd see it was all good. You know, when really we know it's not. And that's what Ivan says. So nothing that could happen could justify the tears of that one child in that outhouse uttering a prayer to dear, kind God. Okay, so you have that one on the one hand. This is what makes Ivan such an attractive character, is this is Mark Twain's rebellion, it's Albert Camus' rebellion, and in a way Albert Camus is Ivan, you know, incarnate. But on the other hand, Ivan brings up another kind of really interesting attack that is against the liberal Protestant, is against the Marxist, is against this whole tradition that comes after Kant that says, oh, you only need the idea of Christ as moral exemplar, and then we can progress to the perfect society, to the moral society. This is a wonderful idea. And yet what Ivan says, it's built on the skulls of billions of people. And he ends, he says, if you could make humanity happy for the rest of eternity by torturing to death one innocent child, would you do it? And of course he says, no, you can't. But the answer to Ivan is right there in the dialogue between Alyosha and Ivan. And Alyosha only says one thing. Well, he does two things. Okay, but he says one thing. One point, he says, Ivan looks at him and says, I'm hurting you. Alyosha is the young, innocent brother. And Alyosha looks at him and says, no, I want to suffer too. And this is Dostoevsky's response. Because he says, he thinks this is Christ's response to, and this is, I think, the response you find actually in the Mormon scriptures about the atonement. Christ says, I want to suffer too. Or Alyosha says, I want to suffer too. And then after he's told the story of the Grand Inquisitor, in the story, remember, even in Ivan's story, the only thing that Christ said, Christ never says anything, he acts. As he leaves, as the Grand Inquisitor releases him from prison, Christ kisses the Grand Inquisitor. As Alyosha and Ivan leave each other from the bar, Alyosha kisses Ivan. What's fascinating about Brothers Karamazov is, one of the things anyway, is that it ends with a tremendous reaffirmation of the resurrection. And in that, what Dostoevsky is doing is reflecting a notion that he is getting from two Russian theologians that he's hanging out with. A fellow named Nikolai Fyodorov and another one, Vladimir Soloviev. And both of them have conceived the idea that the meaning of human existence, and Fyodorov was a really strange guy. He was a librarian who actually, and he was kind of a positivist, but he actually believed that the meaning of human existence had to be the resurrection of the dead. Okay, this is the only way to make the universe just. You know, the dead suffered greatly, so the only way to make the universe just would be to somehow resurrect them. And this is Soloviev's much more sophisticated about this, but it's the same notion. And what's interesting about these two guys, Soloviev and Fyodorov, comes up again in the, and I'm going to do this really quickly, having so much fun I get carried away, but it comes up again in the stories, well, in the theology of Nikolai Berdyaev. I'm cutting about 90% of this out, as you can see, I wrote too much. But Berdyaev and Soloviev tried to reconceive Western metaphysics, and they did it in relation to a 17th century German mystic, Jakob Berma. Now, let me read you just a piece from Berdyaev. I guess I've got to stay next to the microphone here. This is from his book, The Meaning of History. I am thinking of Berma, who is not only a great German mystic, but is also one of the greatest mystics of all time, and particularly of his dark nature of God. Berma's doctrine is closely connected with what I have been saying and offers a concrete illustration of the fundamental hypothesis of metaphysics of history. In fact, I believe it is one of the most important discoveries of the German spirit, where it has not ceased to be applied and developed in the spirit of in the spheres of philosophy, art, and culture in general. This spiritual culture is founded on the apprehension of primal being as a dark and irrational force of obscure origin. Not in the sense of evil, for this darkness goes deeper than the distinction between good and evil. Somewhere in immeasurably greater depths, there exists a state which may be called the Ungrund, or groundlessness, to which neither human words nor the categories of good and evil, nor those of being or non-being are applicable. Ungrund is deeper than anything, and is the primal source of what, according to Berma and Schelling, the 19th century idealist, constitutes the dark nature of God. In the nature of God deeper than him, it lies a sort of primal dark abyss. And its inmost depths, at its inmost depths occurs a theogonic process, or that of divine genesis. This process is secondary when compared with the primal groundlessness and inexpressible abyss, which is irrational and incommensurable with any of our categories. There is a primal source and font of being from which an eternal torrent pours and in which the divine light shines everlastingly while the act of divine genesis is taking place. Now, that's pretty thick stuff, but basically what he's saying by appropriating Derrida's notion of the Ungrund is that, and this is what something I think we could appropriate from these people and actually use in the interpretation of our own scriptural tradition, is that the world comes out of chaos, okay, instead of creation ex nihilo. That the foundation of the world is what Berdyaev is later going to call meonic freedom, which means non-being, in the sense of chaos. And the movement of God is to bring the world from chaos to order. And this is a divine process as well as a human process. The movement of the world is to bring bringing the world from chaos to order is to creating a dialogue between the various parts of this chaotic universe. Now, that cannot be forced. One of the things that Berdyaev comes back to again and again is if it were coerced, it would not be a dialogue. One of the great lines from Berdyaev is that God has less power than a policeman. What God offers us is a moral exemplar. God does that in Christ by descending below all things. This, if I can just give one personal experience, that the first time I felt like I understood sort of what the atonement was about was when I was in France. I was there teaching for BYU Study Abroad, and I had a job every week. We didn't get much money, and I was a graduate student. And I had a job every week of going down and speaking English with a furrier, a man named Monsieur Fuchs. And Monsieur Fuchs, we would always talk religion because he knew I was a Mormon, and he was a libre penseur. He wasn't a believer anymore. But in our discussions, he let me know that during the war he had been a member of the resistance. And what he said was that as a member of the resistance, when he was found out by the Nazis that he was involved in this, they went to his house, they pulled his sister and his mother out, and they machine gunned them. And he looked at me, and he said, here you are from Utah. How can you ever ask me to forgive those Nazis? Now, the obvious answer is, I can't. this was Ivan's question to Alyosha. Now, how can you ask this? One of the stories is about a landlord who has a boy killed. How can you say we should forgive him? Of course I can't say we should forgive him, but this is the meaning of the 122nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants. It's only because Christ descended belief of all things that he can ask us to forgive. We are, Berdyaev would say, Christ does this to enlighten the darkness from within. Let me just end by reading a couple of passages from the Book of Mormon. First one is my favorite. It's from 2 Nephi chapter 9, verse 21. And I like this particularly because the way the atonement is explained in here is not as a suffering for sins, which I think is a valid way to talk about it as a suffering for sins, but that Christ suffers all our pain. It says, "And he cometh into the world that he may save all men, if they will hearken unto his voice. For behold, he suffereth the pains of all men, yea, the pains of every living creature, both men, women, and children, who belong to the family of Adam." And the last one is Alma chapter 7, verse 12. Okay, should have put bookmarks in. And what I like about this is it states that God is learning here too. Okay, this is something I think that we forget a lot in the church. When Christ comes down, he hasn't been a human being yet. He doesn't know how hard it is. But in the Book of Mormon, we're told that he learns. "And he shall go forth suffering pains and afflictions and temptations of every kind, that this, the word might be fulfilled, that which saith that he will take upon him the pains and sicknesses of his people." In verse 12, "And he will take upon him death, that he may loose the bands of death, which bind his people. He may take upon him their infirmities, that his bowels may be filled with mercy according to the flesh, that he may know according to the flesh how to succor his people according to their infirmities." Okay. The notion here, I think, and I'm going to end with this, is it's just that the idea of the atonement that we have in the church is one of kind of mutual suffering together in order to raise the world to be a better place. This is the meaning, I think, of what Alma the elder says in Mosiah when he says, when we're baptized, we take upon us the suffering of other people. Okay. When you're speaking off the cuff, as I had to do with this, because this is about, I've got about 50 pages worth of stuff here that I've got to condense down and turn into some kind of order. You know, it's the theogonic process. But you're right. It's available to us. It's not one that we use very often, I'm afraid. Usually we talk about debt. We talk about a satisfaction theory, which doesn't seem to make sense for us. Even those passages that do, you know, you have that, if God were to do this, he would cease to be God. I think if you read those, if God were to coerce us, God would cease to be God. If God were to force us to do good, God would cease to be God. This is why, at least this is one way we could look at it. This is why Lucifer is a liar from the beginning. It's the big lie, that you could coerce someone to be good.
Do we really have, in your opinion, from what you've read in the church today, a theory of the atonement? I mean, there's folks like Robinson and John Moore, there's been some others, but it seems to me that by and large the emphasis has been stay away from theology, and therefore, if we have a theory of one that we've just fallen into accidentally.
I think you're right. In a way, I like that. Mark Leone, years ago, wrote that book saying that, there's a lot of conformity in the church, but there's no conformity in theology. I mean, you find everything.
Yeah.
you know, that's one thing I like about it, because it leaves us free to do all sorts of theological reflections. It's also something I don't like about it, because nobody takes theological reflection seriously in the church. And we accept a lot of things in our explanation. Problem of evil, and suffering and atonement that we've just kind of picked up from someplace else, which I wish we would think more about. So it's both advantage and the disadvantage, I think, at the same time. Yeah.
I guess it's okay to talk about it. It's probably on the internet. There's a movie, a couple of 3 years ago, a movie of questions put into the question to get out of qualification part. And I wonder if you would have a question about it. You know, it's talking about whether if I took it in one of these four, but I don't answer honestly yet.
I think so, yeah. I think so. I think the one problem I have with I love the moral theory. You know, I think you could, I think you just have to believe the story somehow. You know, the answer yes, because I like that kind of toughness about things in the church. But for a long time, I held to the moral theory in the sense of, well, you know, just Christ is an ideal exemplar. I was heavily influenced by Kahn Hegel. But then, after a while, it started working on me that, in order to have an exemplar, you got to actually have somebody that pulled it off. And I think that is something that's central to the church. We have to believe Christ actually pulled it off. For Kant, you didn't need that. And for a good deal of liberal theologians, you didn't need that. You just needed the idea that, well, we've got a story here about somebody that pulled it off. And I think you have to go beyond the story to believing that in this case, the story actually does match reality somehow.
Mm-hmm.